This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Sigital and author of Software Security. This podcast is co-sponsored by IEEE Security Privacy Magazine and Sigital. A portion of this interview will appear in print in the November-December issue. And this is a fifth in a series of interviews with security gurus. Today I have with me Professor Ed Felton from Princeton. Hi, Ed.
Hey, Gary.
Ed is a professor of computer science and public affairs at Princeton University, and he's the director of the Center for Information Technology Policy. Ed is very well known for his work at the intersection of privacy, security, and technology, especially regarding digital protection, content protection. One of the best blogs on the net is Freedom to Tinker, which Ed also runs, and he's well known for his work with the Microsoft antitrust trial, where he was a star witness for the DOJ. He did early work in Java security with me, and we wrote a couple of books together. And before that, he got a PhD from the University of Washington. Now he lives in Princeton, New Jersey with his family, but we're talking to Ed in California. Hi, Ed.
Hey, Gary.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
So on your blog, you make a bunch of predictions for 2006. And so I wondered how you're doing with those predictions.
Well, I'll have to go and look and see what remind myself what I predicted. Let me take a look here.
and the real question is whether you have any sort of last-minute changes to the predictions.
Oh, that wouldn't be fair.
Since we're halfway through the year.
The whole point of predictions is that you have to stick with what you predicted. All right, let's see what I predicted here. A sort of mid-year scorecard. Number one, digital rights management technology will still fail to prevent widespread infringement. In a related development, pigs will still fail to fly. I'm pretty confident on that one.
So that one's working out as planned.
As planned, but I predict that every year, and it turns out to be true every year.
Are there any that you felt like you were going out on a limb with?
Oh, yeah.
Why don't we look at those?
The recording industry will quietly reduce the number of lawsuits it files against end users. That one, I think, has not happened. Google Book search case will settle. Predicted that. And that has not happened yet, although the case seems to have fallen off the front pages. In any case, it will become trendy to say that the Internet is broken and needs to be redesigned, and this meme will be especially popular with those recommending bad policies. I think it has become a bit trendy to say that the Internet is broken.
Yeah, what was that famous quote about the Internet being pipes and they were filled of...
Oh, right. This was Senator Ted Stevens.
That was a good one.
Famously quoted saying, the Internet is a series of tubes. It's not a dump truck that you can just dump stuff on. And I think he was trying to make a point that the Internet can get congested. And
I think that's because he was trying to get the Internet into his office.
He was trying to get the Internet into his office, yep. And all he had was tubes? Who knows? Yeah. So here's another one, actually, where I went out on a limb a little bit, saying that push technology, as in Pointcast and the Windows Active Desktop and all that, will come back.
Right.
This time with multimedia. I don't know that this has happened.
So 10 years later, why did you think that was going to happen?
Well, it just seemed to me that the way that people were moving in delivering multimedia, audio and video and so on, was in that area there were people who wanted a TV-like model, and there were people also who wanted to be able to choose their content. So if you think about something like, say, a TiVo device that lets you choose your programming off a menu of recorded programs, and you sort of put that together with delivery of material over the net, what you get is a device that sort of delivers a menu of stuff to your net over the net to your device, and then you can sort of pick what's there. Mm-hmm. And that's rather like push technology.
It's sort of, well...
That was the theory.
Sounds to me like a RSS feed, sort of, too.
It's kind of, yeah, it's kind of like RSS. It's kind of like podcasting with a maybe slightly more friendly for the average user interface.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So kind of like what we're doing here, I guess.
Yeah, so you could change your prediction to that won't happen.
I could change, right. I just put the word not in. That's the nice thing about a blog is you can just go back and edit it later.
Which you would never do, of course.
I would never. Well, it's been against the blogger's code to change the meaning without actually putting a note at the bottom saying I changed the meaning.
The unspoken blogger's code.
Right. So here's another prediction. There will be a felony conviction in the U.S. for a crime committed entirely in a virtual world. That one I thought I was going out on a limb. I don't know of anything happening there.
Yeah.
But it seems like with all the money that's at stake in virtual worlds, it won't be long before something like this happens. And there was the pretty famous incident on Second Life where someone created an object that was essentially a denial of service attack on the world.
Uh-huh.
An object that replicated itself, and then the replicas replicated themselves and so on. And so once you set this thing loose, it would basically fill up the entire world with copies of itself, and eventually the servers would crash.
A little virus, really.
Yeah, kind of like a virus, except it was an object that had a presence in the virtual world.
So you know there was an object like that in World of Warcraft too, that turned out to be a virus that escaped this one little area where it was supposed to be kind of constrained,
right,
and ended up wiping out a large number of the population.
Right, ended up killing individuals or killing characters.
That's right.
The Second Life thing was just an inanimate object that, just some kind of floating blob. But you get too many floating blobs in the same area, and the servers that manage the world will crash.
Interesting.
And the FBI got called in, at least in the Second Life case.
Because it was done maliciously, they were looking for intent.
Yeah, it was pretty obviously done maliciously. Someone had done it once, and they were sort of given a stern talking to, and they did it again. And so then the cops got called.
So let's switch gear from prognostication to something else. A lot of your career since 1995 has involved taking on huge corporations or organizations and sometimes even governments. I'm thinking of things like taking on Sun with Java Security, Microsoft with a DOJ trial, the RIAA, the Sony with the rootkit stuff, and sometimes even Congress. So a question about that is, do you ever worry about making powerful enemies? Have you seen any evidence that your, you know, career in public service is dangerous?
I don't think it depends what you mean by dangerous. If you mean, you know, do people get angry? Yes, I know they do. And a few of them hold the grudge, but mostly they don't, actually. I think if people are convinced that you're calling it as you see it, and that it's not about a vendetta against anyone in particular, but if they believe that what you say is really driven by sort of what are the technical facts on the ground, then I think they will, over time, come to accept that it's annoying at times, but it's not spiteful.
So that laundry list that we went over, the companies that I mentioned, have all of them sort of come around to your point of view, you think?
I think, well, for the most part, I have good relations with all of those organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I was just invited to a meeting with one of them a few days ago. Right now, Microsoft is the main funder of my research.
Interesting.
Despite the opposition in the antitrust case. And there are lots of examples of this. I think, you know, some individuals remain angry, but on the whole, I've been pleasantly surprised.
Who do you think had to move the farthest in their position to understand the objective reality that you're trying to present?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think in some cases, the sort of the emphasis on the issue that there was disagreement about has just passed. In the case of Java, for example, you know, Java security was a huge deal at a time, and Sun had really enormous aspirations for Java.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think their aspirations are more narrow, and the uses to which Java is put raise different kinds of security problems than the ones that we were looking at back then. And so the issue about which there was disagreement just isn't as big a deal anymore. And sometimes it's just sort of procedural. You know, I worked on the Microsoft antitrust case working with the Department of Justice.
Right, yeah.
And that case, of course, was eventually settled. And right now, Microsoft and the DOJ are basically getting along under the terms of the settlement. And so it's not an area in which there's continuing serious dispute.
So one where there does seem to be a continuous dispute going on would be with digital protection in the RIAA.
That's right, yes. I mean, so there's still a fight over digital protection or digital rights management technology. And it involves a lot of different players, not only the record companies and the movie studios, but a lot of technology companies are building business strategies around this stuff, Apple being a very prominent example of somebody mm-hmm. who's accumulated a lot of market power by clever use of digital rights management technology.
Right.
In fact, that's sort of the main effect that Apple's DRM has had, is not to prevent copying, but to give Apple market power,
right.
Help them shape and control what happens with online music.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So one of the things that you've had to do because of your involvement with these high-profile situations is become media savvy. And I think over the years you've become very media savvy. It now seems like you know how to get attention and keep it with a clever hook. And the question is, where did that skill come from?
Well, it's partly practice, seeing what happens when you say something or act in a particular way, and then seeing how it ends up in the media. One of the things I learned early on was that if you're reporting a security flaw in something, that the media wants to portray it as a this person says X, that person says not X kind of story.
Right.
And that story doesn't really inform anybody.
I remember some of those when we were supposedly fighting with Netscape.
Right, exactly. And it's much more productive to try to find a way to tell the story in a way that the vendor can actually agree with. And that has to do partly with how you present the story initially to the public, and it also has to do with talking to the vendor in the right way beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it has to do with trying to talk to the companies that are involved in the right way in advance, so you really don't get people contradicting each other in the media, but instead you can sort of agree on what's true and what's not.
Have you found that the kinds of analogies and metaphors that you're using have shifted over the years as you've done more public discourse than, say, speaking to technologists? I'm thinking, in the early days in the mid-90s, we were releasing things to the media, but it was mostly the tech media. And now
right.
when you're testifying in front of Congress, you have these guys who are lawmakers who may not be computer people.
Right. And
or
so
clearly are computer people.
Yeah, and so you obviously have to use an analogy that is closer to what they're used to. And I found a lot of value in using analogy to older technologies. Like the
tubes.
Tubes, pneumatic tubes. No, the telephone system, transportation, cars and airplanes and so on. Are very useful. Also making analogies, especially in security cases, to situations where people are used to seeing security technologies, like, an automatic teller machine.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole set of security mechanisms around that, the receipt, the camera, the way the records are kept, the encryption of the connection back to the bank.
The limited amount of money in the machine itself.
Limited amount of money in the machine itself, limitations on how much you can take out at any one time. The whole problem of counterfeit machines, and you can get to a lot of interesting security problems by using analogies like that. And choosing the right analogy is incredibly important.
What do you think is the most powerful analogy that you've come up with along those lines?
So in the case of DRM, I think analogizing it to, and so DRM technology is really about really what the way it works in the technical guts is it's about controlling what devices can be compatible with what other devices.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, and you can make a lot of ground in this area by abstracting it to other cases, even low-tech cases of where compatibility is important, compatibility of, say, tires with the wheels of a car, mm-hmm. compatibility of compact discs with CD players, compatibility of stereo speakers with the equipment that drives them, and all of this, even the compatibility sort of a antenna broadcasting television with the antenna and TV that are receiving it. And when you talk about people designing technology that is deliberately incompatible. And then you talk about the government actually passing laws to foster this deliberate incompatibility. I think it brings home to people the fundamental strangeness of digital rights management.
Right, right. So you spent your last sabbatical with Larry Lessig at Stanford Law School.
Right.
And one question that computer scientists probably want to know is, why is public policy and the law so important for a computer scientist to be working on?
Well, it's becoming, I think, more and more so. That it used to be that the stuff that we as computer scientists did was not all that interesting to most of the people in the world. I mean, yeah, high tech was cool. People had seen computers, but nowadays so much of what happens in everyday life is mediated by computer technology. And policymakers have figured out that that regulating the technology is a way that they can try to sort of pull the levers and control the way the world develops and the way people behave. Sometimes they think it's easier to control the technology than to control the behavior that the technology enables.
Right.
And so then they get in and start messing around with the technology. And so it used to be that, you know, you could go months without having any hearings on Capitol Hill related to computer technology.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are multiple hearings every week. And all kinds of different committees of Congress are talking about doing all kinds of different stuff. You know, they worry about gambling, and that's now considered a technology problem. They worry about, child molesters and child stalkers, and that's viewed as a technology problem.
Mm-hmm.
They view...
Do you think that's because of the newness of the technology? Kind of like, you know, people would say telephone involved in murder back in the turn of the century,
right.
And now they would
exactly
say
the
that.
Telephone murders. And nowadays, if a telephone is involved or if an automobile is involved, it's just normal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's partly the hype, but it's also partly that in fact computers and the internet are used in lots of everyday activities. And I think to people who don't understand them, it seems easy to regulate and control the way they work in order to change behavior.
Right. Well, you and I sort of agree that having technological tools to deeply probe security is important, you know, in order to, say, cut through snake oil or expose things that don't work. And
right.
Some of these tools, I'm thinking of decompilers and rootkits in particular, are now being abused by the good guys, and of course some are standard tools for the bad guys. So I think there's an important lesson there that technology is agnostic.
For the most part, yeah. And it's valuable. I think there's a real tendency of policymakers who don't understand technology to try to outlaw broad categories of technology, not realizing how much the good guys make use of the very same tools that the bad guys use.
Right.
And again, this is a case where analogies are really valuable. You can talk about something like a kitchen knife or a crowbar.
Mm-hmm.
It can be used to cause all kinds of harm, but you certainly wouldn't want to try. You wouldn't want to outlaw kitchen knives, nor would you want to have regulations micromanaging the design of kitchen knives to make them less dangerous.
Well, here's sort of a philosophy question for you then: is there any sort of technology that deserves to be outlawed prima facie?
I think you can think of a very few technologies that are so inherently dangerous. That just having them around is dangerous. But I'm thinking more of sort of biological and nuclear agents, for example.
Yeah, right. How about universal computing machines?
Yeah, I mean, if you're talking about... right, exactly. Universal computing machines are much too dangerous to allow. But when you talk about security technology, no, I think it depends on how it's being used and how it's being protected and so on. I think it's very dangerous to say that there are certain sorts of things that are off limits, even for the good guys doing good things. This is really just a road to not understanding.
Right.
And giving the bad guys the advantage of knowing more about how their bad technology works than we do.
I, for one, believe that we have to do all that we can to really understand what security attacks are like. Because if we don't, we're just going to be building pretend solutions.
Right, and it's easy to build pretend solutions, and it's easy to sell them if there's nobody out there who's talking about whether they're really effective and what the bad guys actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a dangerous syndrome you can get into where we try to keep ourselves from understanding how our systems can fail rather than keeping them from failing. And you see this all over the place. You see this in security. We've seen this a lot in e-voting, where it seems like sometimes the goal of some people is to prevent finding out about problems rather than to prevent problems.
Right. So a slightly different topic. What book are you reading today?
What book am I reading today?
What are you in the middle of?
Let's see. Well, I'm on vacation.
Perfect.
So that kind of doesn't count.
Sure it does.
Back at the office, what's the book I've read last? The last book I've been reading actually was Yochai Benkler's book, The Wealth of Networks, which is new this summer. And I think it's a pretty important work about technology policy. It's also a very difficult book to get through.
So that's fine, but I'm more interested in what book you're reading on vacation.
What book I'm reading on vacation? So let's see. I've got a P.D. James novel mystery here, and I've got a book about the history of baseball statistics called The Numbers Game. Those are the two books I brought along on the vacation.
That's good. And then a last question for you. What is the biggest challenge with trying to raise an 11-year-old girl?
Oh, what's the biggest challenge? I think the biggest challenge is to keep a, you know, I don't know if this is true about kids in general, but I think probably it's true about mine. It's just trying to keep them engaged in the world and you know, keep them believing that they can do great things if they work at it. You know, kids naturally, I think, have a lot of curiosity and really want to get involved in things. And just keeping that alive while they learn more and become more capable, I think, is the most important thing.
That's good. So they can become little tinkerers.
Little tinkerers, that's the goal, yeah. Whether it's, you know, whether it's writing or whatever. Yeah, getting them creating stuff and trying things out.
Great. Well, thanks for your discussion today.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. The November-December issue of IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine will feature a print version of this interview. In addition, the issue will feature articles on data surveillance and privacy protection, as well as regular departments on building security in and on the horizon. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show notes, links, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.
It's not something that you just dump something on. It's not a big truck. It's a series of tubes.